Hello and welcome to our DC Diversity Dive, a podcast in which our diversity and inclusion team aim to recognise and support cultural practices and celebrations. Delta Kappa embraces and celebrates equality and diversity. It takes the steps necessary to ensure these values are recognised, for example, through the work of our Diversity and Inclusion Committee and by fostering diverse thought. Women's Equality Day is observed on August 26th each year in the US to commemorate the passage of the 19th Amendment to the US Constitution, which granted women the right to vote. The amendment was certified on August 26, 1920, after a long and hard-fought struggle known as the Women's Suffrage Movement. Women's Equality Day not only commemorates the ratification of the 19th Amendment, but also serves as a reminder of the ongoing fight for women's rights and gender equality. So while women gained the right to vote with the 19th Amendment, the struggle for full gender equality has continued in many areas, such as employment, education, reproductive rights, and representation in leadership roles. The day is about uplifting and empowering women and marvelling at how far women have progressed, defying all odds and many layers of oppression. General traditions of the day include people of all genders expressing gratitude to influential women in their lives, for example, supporting local businesses run by women, and also celebrating womanhood through various events, seminars, and activities to not only celebrate the progress made, but also raise awareness around the issues that need attention. Funds can be raised for charities and organisations that support women's empowerment, and prominent women are also featured as guest speakers on various virtual and live platforms. This year is all about embracing equity, and I thought I could give you some interesting facts to get you thinking about equity in the world we live in. So 18 is the number of countries where husbands can legally prevent their wives from working. 108 is the estimated number of years it will take to bridge the gender gap. And 47% is the percentage of increased likelihood for women to suffer severe injuries in car crashes because safety features are designed for men. Today, we'll be discussing some of the barriers to achieving gender equity as we embody our value of Be Direct with our guest speakers, Diane Eshleman, our Chief Sustainability Officer, Sarah Brennan, our Global Head of L&D and Academy, and Lena Panilla, an AVP within our CLM team in the US.
Thanks, April. So it's been 103 years since American women were finally given the right to vote. And so that is progress by itself. Only 8 years later, women in Britain were given the right to vote. But interestingly, it wasn't until 1971 that in Switzerland, women were given the opportunity to participate in the election process. And as many of you know, it's only 5 years ago, in 2018, that Saudi women were given the right to drive a car. So while all of this represents progress, globally, there still is quite a bit of discrimination. Notably, there's very uneven access to education. There are legal and/or religious restrictions against women and girls. There are areas across the globe where child marriage is still common. There clearly are some hurdles and some challenges that we need to address.
Yeah, it's shocking, isn't it, when you hear some of those stats? Driving a car, I mean, All the situations where it's probably men designing things for men, and women are overlooked, and actually it's a real health and safety risk. I've just found that really shocking, and it's such a high percentage as well.
So despite progress in women's rights, the gender pay gap remains a prominent issue, with the World Economic Forum reporting in 2023 that progress is stalling, with the current global gender gap standing at 31.6%. How can we bridge this gap and ensure equal pay for equal?
Thanks, April. I think you covered off earlier that it will take something like 108 years to close that gap. And I think depending on where you look, it's even more scary than that. So the World Economic Forum, I know, reports it will take around 131 years. According to ActionAid, it could take 257 years to close the gap. There are more women entering into male-dominated professions like medicine and law. But these stats that we've just quoted there show there's such a long way to go. I think with gender pay gap, we need to be clear that we're talking about unequal pay for equal work. So the issue isn't generally about, do we pay a man more for doing the exact same job as a woman? In the UK and many other countries, it's illegal to do that. So there are laws preventing that from happening. However, we do know that that practice does still exist in certain industries. But the key issue tends to be that there are roles that involve a different set of skills or qualifications, responsibilities, but they do represent equal value, and so they merit equal pay. So an example would be a job in the male-dominated construction sector looks very different to one in the female-dominated childcare sector. But the level of skill, effort, responsibility, even working conditions may be similar, yet the childcare job will often be lower paid. And this is a real issue. You know, it's not just these industries that we're talking about. We see this elsewhere as well. And we know that leadership positions, so senior roles in businesses, are often occupied by men. And this, again, adds to this issue. There's a lot of reasons for this. Systemic inequality is at the root cause of it. But even if a lot of these women do get a decent education and they have access to all of the same opportunities as men, it doesn't always guarantee a good job for them at the other side because of this kind of inequality that exists, this is systemic inequality. So I was reading recently that the majority of CEO roles are filled by those that have been promoted from either a CFO position or a COO position. So I was having a look at typically, you know, how many females occupy those CFO roles or those COO roles. And again, that's quite depressing as well. So these pathways to allow women to progress into these roles that are typically occupied by men, they're non-existent or they're really tough. So I think there's a lot that we can do to support women into these more senior roles. And that would absolutely tackle this gender pay gap or a large issue with it. I think it was something like 23% of CFO roles in the UK are filled by women. And that was actually a lot higher than it used to be. So I think when we're looking at what we can do, I think a huge focus needs to be on recruitment and our recruitment processes. How do we recruit? Are we always attracting the same types of individuals for roles, particularly the CFO, COO, CEO roles? Are we looking for people who are just like us as recruiters? Are we breaking the mold a bit? Are we looking for diversity? And I think, you know, proactive recruitment is definitely something that attracts far more women. When we're reactive in the way that we recruit, and we see this in Delta Capita as well, we tend to get far more male applicants coming for the roles because the market has more of them in there for these particular roles. So if we're more planned around our recruitment, we are more strategic in how we approach it, we run campaigns, I think, you know, we stand a much better chance of attracting female candidates to some of those more senior leadership positions. And that's something that I'm working with Ellie on actually at the moment in DC to try and do that and to try and be more proactive in our recruitment practices for that very reason. And then obviously there's this part around, if we attract female talent into the business, how do we support them? How do we nurture that talent and make sure that it's a safe place where women can progress and succeed? And so at the moment, we've got a leadership development program running, and I'll ask Lena in a second her input on that because she's actually on it as one of our females in the business. But we're running things like that to support our women, future leaders, current leaders, the kind of rising stars across the company. And there's more we can do around that. You know, a lot of businesses are operating programs just for women so that they can support female talent. And there's a lot that we can do around flexible working practices that mean that women are typically more supported because they tend to be the ones that need more flexibility around families and so on. Again, very stereotypical, but it is the case. And we see that. And in DC, we've a number of flexible working policies that support that. I think just looking at how we approach the support that we offer our female leaders and building male allies around the business to do that will definitely pave the way for being able to make some changes there. So I mentioned there, Lena, that we're running our leadership development program. Do you just want to input on what your experience of it is as a woman on that program currently and how you're finding it?
Thank you, Sarah. It's a huge responsibility and a milestone in my career. It's commonly known that in the financial industry, the majority of senior and leadership roles are attained by men, which makes me very proud to be representing women that work in finance. I'm a Latin woman in New York, and going through the leadership path makes me feel proud of my roots, the knowledge I have gained through the years, my education, and my family who has supported me through my career success. Being able to represent women in the financial industry and to guide other women to attain that confidence and grow as persons and leaders is my main purpose. My path was tough at the beginning here in the US, as per the career I chose was man-dominated, but I never gave up. I was strong enough to surpass all the obstacles. It happened to me as well when I was in Colombia and I was CEO of a mining company, which is a sector that is dominated by men as well. After challenges, I gained the respect of them. With this new role, I want to inspire other women who want to advance their careers in the financial industry. I would say that being bold, disciplined, and being confident has been my interior guidance through my career path. And that will definitely be my advice to women who want to excel in the financial industry.
That's brilliant. And I think looking at how many former CFOs, COOs go on to become CEOs, I think as a company, it's something that I'm focusing on, and I'm sure Diane will be involved in this as well, is looking at whether there's a program we can develop for our female employees that develops those skills that are needed to progress into those CEO positions, leadership positions of the future, specifically targeting the traits and the skills that we see develop through those roles. So without them needing to go down that route, Chanel and Xerox have appointed female CEOs. And they've done that as a result of promoting those out of the HR profession. So they've taken a slightly different route. And I keep on reading, I'm not just being biased here, having had a career in HR, but I keep reading so many articles about how those with that people experience and working in HR and similar professions really lends itself to developing those CEO qualities. So I think it's about time that we did start to think outside the box a bit and think about the different traits and skills and attributes that really lend themselves to those senior roles and look elsewhere as well.
So we know that women only hold 10.4% of leadership positions at Fortune 500 companies, and only 9% of FTSE 100 companies have a female CEO. So what are the barriers that women face in reaching leadership positions, and how can we encourage and support more women to step into these leadership roles?
I think there are at least three major barriers. One is the disproportionate responsibility that women have when raising families. Even if they can wedge a career into those obligations, the availability and prohibitive cost of childcare can be a real barrier. Second, there still is some very stereotypical thinking about the roles that men can play versus women. So, for example, it's not uncommon for men to believe that women can't travel, partly because of their family obligations, or won't be willing or able to work long hours. And that becomes prohibitive in defining a role that's as appropriate for a woman as for a man. And then thirdly, there's the perennial issue of unconscious bias among decision makers and the risk that someone who is the hiring manager, often a man, because these senior leadership positions are dominated by men, will run the risk of hiring what is in effect a mini-me, somebody who looks like them, you know, has the same background and clearly is the same gender. So there are other barriers as well, but I think those three, the disproportionate responsibility for childcare, stereotypical thinking, and unconscious bias are among the most serious ones.
Yeah, I agree. Linking into what I was talking about earlier, that unconscious bias is such a challenge for us. And I think that's something that companies can definitely focus on as well, reducing that for any hiring managers, for anybody involved in recruitment, just ensuring that they're managers, their recruitment team, they've all gone through some sort of training around this to make sure that it's not such an issue there, but it's difficult. I mean, we know that it exists, and even with training, it's difficult to stamp out, and we've seen that.
I'm with you 100%. Even if you have a diverse candidate slate for a new role or a promotion, if you have gender bias in the role profile or a non-diverse selection panel, then that unconscious bias is going to factor in. And it's a serious issue that has to be addressed. There's also the need we have for more flexible working arrangements and mentoring. Mentoring is key. And it's men mentoring women, but it's also more senior women mentoring more junior women to try to help them on the path to leadership roles.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, a lot of women really struggle with childcare costs as well in returning to work. It's a huge consideration. And I've had so many friends that have said to me, when I work it out financially, it's just not worth me going back for what I'm going to be spending on childcare. I might as well just stay at home. And so there's always that challenge of, do I pay it and continue with my career, or do we take the hit financially, and, you know, and, or we don't, and then I'm at home and I get to spend time with my kids. And I think there's always that guilt as well, whichever way you decide to opt in, whether it's the childcare route, you feel the guilt of being away from your kids, and you're actually worse off financially quite often and making these sacrifices to not spend time with your children, or you're at home with your kids and you feel like you've sacrificed your career. You know, it's very difficult to win, I think, as women. And I was reading something recently and it said 76% of mothers with children under the age of 10 say that childcare is one of their top challenges, compared to just 54% of men with young children. And I think since COVID as well, women in particular have struggled. I think it's something like women are 1.5 times more likely than senior level men to think about downshifting their careers or leaving the workforce because of COVID. Because we know that during COVID, it was often the women that were more impacted negatively. They were the ones that had to take the time out to educate, homeschool, time away from the office, be more flexible. And so, unfortunately, if women leaders do leave the workforce, I guess the women that remain are losing their most positive and most powerful allies and champions alongside them. So yeah, it's kind of a double whammy, a double negative effect.
And I think now we can think about, how can we challenge and break those gender stereotypes to create a more inclusive and equitable society for everyone?
According to a research from Harvard Business Review, women make up more than half of the labor force in the United States and earn almost 60% of advanced degrees. But they bring home less pay and fill less seats in the C-suite than male, especially in male-dominated professions like finance and technology. We need to overcome some challenges such as pay gap and give quality opportunities to women who are highly prepared and educated. I feel that women can do it all. We can be successful businesswomen without taking away from also being wives, mothers, and anything in between. Also, I would say that in politics, there's a stereotype that power positions are majoritarily held by men. Actually, while most countries in the world have not achieved gender parity, gender quotas have substantially contributed to progress over the years. In countries with legislated candidate quotas, women's representation is 5 percentage points higher in parliaments compared to countries without such legislation, according to the UN. I believe that the quota allocation for women in politics is important in order to challenge gender stereotypes to create a more inclusive and equitable society.
I thought it'd be great to discuss the role of men as allies in the fight for women's equality. So how can men actively support and champion gender equality and gender equity?
So I think that education is the key. I believe that it's important that parents raise their kids as equals, go to the same school, having the same opportunities, no matter gender, and empower them. That's the best way that we can champion gender equity.
Yeah, I agree, Lena. I think it starts at such a young age. And my daughter's 9 at the moment, and she's at that weird age that girls go through where they lose a bit of confidence. And all of a sudden, the boys in her class have so much confidence, bags of it. And I think it comes down to parenting, you know, teachers doing a great job of this as well. Just educating boys from a really young age that they are allies to these girls. You know, if somebody is lacking confidence, don't use it. Don't play on that weakness and dive in. You know, be respectful, invite the conversation and invite the answering. Give somebody a chance in class to put their hand up and have a say. Don't kind of, you know, it's not everything's a competition. And I say that with a slight laugh in my voice, because I've also got a 3-year-old boy who I absolutely know is going to be that 9-year-old boy at some point that does see it as competition and sees it as a weakness that he can dive in and, you know, get all the answers in there before the girls do. So it's going to be an education process with him, I am quite sure. But I think as well, educating our girls that they can reach out to their male counterparts and ask for support. They can be vulnerable. It's not a sign of weakness. And I think parents and teachers being tuned into this, inviting it and being supportive of it will make a world of difference to the future generations. I really do.
Yeah, I agree completely with both of you. Let's also accept the fact that most senior decision makers are men. And so they will have the opportunity to ensure that there's a lack of bias in hiring, in compensation, in promotions, and they can be effective mentors to women in their careers. They can really advocate for women, both individually and collectively. So we can't ignore the fact that today, most of the policies and decision makers in corporate America are going to be men, and making them sensitive to some of these gender specific issues is key.
Yeah. Absolutely, I agree.
So to wrap up the podcast, I thought it'd be good to do some rapid fire questions. So number one is, what is something that people misunderstand about you?
I think I'm a slightly odd mix of being highly extroverted, and that's what people see in me, yet also needing quite a bit of quiet time to myself where I actually recharge, get a bit more energy when I'm on my own. So I'm a bit of an ambivert, I guess. So I love being around people. I do my thinking out loud, you know, I like to work as part of a team, but I also need to shut myself away at times. And I think sometimes it confuses people a bit. They see me as this extrovert, and it often surprises them when I need to go to the other extreme at times. So that's mine.
Mine is, sometimes people think that when you're coming from a Latin country to the US, you have to start your career from scratch, as if you didn't have previous experience. In my case, I have more than 8 degrees, and half of them were in Colombia. And we have a great education as well. So I would say that that's a misunderstanding.
Wow. Did you say 8 degrees, Lena?
Yes, I do. I have 8 degrees, 4 in Colombia and 4 in the US.
That's incredible.
Yeah. Very impressive. Very impressive. For me, it would be, I think, generally, you're viewed by your current role. And so a lot of people think I'm a lifelong sustainability professional, when in fact, I was a banker for over 30 years. I ran some big global businesses. I founded my own consulting company with Wall Street clients. So although I have a lot of passion around sustainability, it has not been the anchor in my career.
What are the best and worst pieces of career advice you've ever received?
So my worst ever piece of advice, I'm really ashamed to say, was from a female colleague of mine, really early on in my career. And she took me to one side to advise me that if I ever wanted to be taken seriously in business, I should stop dyeing my hair blonde. Of course, I completely ignored it. My hair is bleached within an inch of its life. But it's just shocking. We're going back probably 20 years, but another female taking someone to one side to guide them in that. The best bit of advice I've had is probably to be courageous, be myself, to do things with passion and to try new things.
For me, I would say that the best advice I have received is to trust in my knowledge and talents. And the worst piece of career advice I have received is when someone told me that I had to prioritize myself over others. I would say that this is a terrible advice because values matter and you can't overstep people. You have to always work with others and understand their priorities as well.
For me, the worst piece of advice was, don't ever talk about your family. Don't have a picture of your children on your laptop or your desk surface. Don't remind people that you're a parent or that you're a mother, in fact, because they will make assumptions about you and your ability to work a certain number of hours or travel that are inappropriate. Best piece of advice I ever received came actually from one of my early managers who said, there's no substitute for hard work. So work like a dog. You need to understand the different direction that a man may take when he thinks about solving a problem. So work like a dog, think like a man, but always act like a lady. Don't degrade your language or your behavior to the lowest common denominator in the workplace.
Love that. Do you know what? Your first example, Diane, reminds me of somebody I met at an event. And she worked in banking for many, many years, and she'd retired by the point that I met her. And she actually hid for the majority of her career that she had children. And nobody knew at work because she was advised exactly the same, you know, don't let on that you've got a family. So she would take these calls from school when her kids were sick, and she'd have to pretend it was a business call and she couldn't go and collect them. And I just thought, God, how stressful is that, you know, having to conceal such a huge and important part of your life.
That's great. For our last question, who are your favourite people to follow in business? What do you like about what they're doing?
I think for me, it's probably a really obvious one, but Sheryl Sandberg to me just really stands out. I think she's really lean in. I think it was released back in 2013 or something. It's about 10 years ago. And she really shone a light on some of the challenges that females in business face. She was just so real about it. And I think what I love about her and what she's continued to do is not be afraid to be her whole self and bring her whole self to the business and use that to educate others and support other women. And I know a few years after Lean In was released, she lost her husband, sadly, and she went on to write Option B. And again, you know, she dealt with grief and trauma in such a very real way, relating it to work and life. And she doesn't ever try to separate the two. She's one person, unashamedly one person. And that is her whole self, and it's her whole self in her home life, her work life. And so I think she's just so relatable, and she challenges in the best way on some of the most difficult topics and really surfaces those things that we should be talking about, but in a non-confrontational, aggressive way. And I just think she's great. So she's somebody that I've followed for quite a long time now.
In my case, there's one that I really admire, but he passed away a long time ago, was John D. Rockefeller. I really loved his humanity. He had a purpose with his business. He was a philanthropist. Most of his income was to invest in education. He was a contributor for the University of Chicago, Yale, Harvard, Columbia. I believe that education is a game changer in society. And also his business approach and practices were outstanding and bold. That's how he built a great empire. Also, there's a quote that I really like from Rockefeller, which states the following. I do not think there's any other quality so essential to success of any kind as the quality of perseverance. It overcomes almost everything, even nature. I try to apply this to my life always. I think that perseverance is the key for success.
For me, the two people I would cite, they're not directly in business, they're in politics, I guess, but would be Christine Lagarde, who is the president of the European Central Bank, and Janet Yellen, who is the U.S. Secretary of the Treasury. I think both of them are incredibly bright, talented, and completely unafraid of making some really tough decisions that have implications across the globe, in fact.
That's great. Thank you, everyone. A big thank you to Diane, Sarah, and Lena for their insightful responses and for sharing their experiences and thoughts associated with Women's Equality Day. A few points that particularly stood out for me were that we've got to unpack unconscious biases in the workplace and in society, especially from men in those senior positions. And these men should also be supporting the women and gender equality themselves. How we support women going into those senior roles and allow space for women who have, for example, families, caring responsibilities, and other aspects of their lives outside work. And also how we think about what men versus women can do in the workplace, for example, the skill sets we value as a side to, and also how we think about what men and women can offer in the workplace in some terms of skills, the difference in value that's put on skill sets such as childcare versus building, for example, and how HR roles that are commonly filled by women are actually the roles that are building the skills that we want to see from a CEO. These conversations are vital to how we can prioritize encouraging discussions on equality in the workplace. Thank you for listening to this discussion, and please look out for more content from Delta Capter on our website, deltacapter.com, our LinkedIn page, and lastly, our Instagram @delta.capter.